Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Saturday Morning Tech Show. My name is Todd Cochran. And yes, I want to thank Jeffrey Powers for that nice little graphic included Saturday Morning Tech pre-roll. So, everyone, welcome to the show. And we've got our co-host, Rob Greenlee, on the bottom. Good morning, Rob. How are you?
Good. I'm doing fantastic.
Well, that's good.
Almost Christmas.
Yes, it is almost Christmas. And matter of fact, you know, I was kind of worried about doing this show because I was saying, man, no one's going to be around. Everyone's going to be mobile and heading off to grandma's. And I thought, well, maybe not. Christmas is on Tuesday, so we might be able to pull it off. And we got lucky. Paul Thurrott, good morning. How are you from WinSuperSite.com? How are you this morning, Paul?
Thank you. It's noon, but it feels early for me here. I guess it's worse for you.
So at least, you know, you're on the East Coast, so it's not as bad. You know, you didn't have to wake up at 5:30 in the morning on a Saturday morning. I don't know why I do this myself, but it is what it is.
You can't explain the love.
Yeah, and what I did was, I mean, when I started this show, I said, okay, I got to have a third show, but I got to be able to do it in a way that doesn't piss my wife off. I have to have it at a time that it will not interfere with too much family stuff going on. But you know, sure, what ended up happening being is, like, all of a sudden my kids are like doing swim meets, and she's like grumbling this morning, you could have took them to school if you didn't take them to the swim meet if you didn't have your show, and then cross country, and so it's, you know, all good plans go to waste. So
yeah.
So anyway, but that's okay. That's all right. So, hey, you know, Paul, I have to ask right off the bat. You know, you got your pulse on the Windows 8 thing. The hoopla has kind of quieted down, and it's looked like maybe Microsoft is starting to settle into a, you know, just standard release, and not too much. Looks like there's starting to be some adoption. Are you seeing that?
Yeah, the data that I have shows that Windows 8 is actually down pretty significantly from Windows 7. Mm-hmm. And more recently, though, the retail assessment seems to be that Windows 8 is at least not harming things. That it's not helping the industry, but it's not harming the industry either. So I think it has. I think you're right. I think it has settled in.
You know, I've got to let me see what I've got. If I can find them here real quick. Yeah, I've got them here. Yeah, can I bring them out? No, I can't reach them. I've got two Windows 8 install CDs, and I'm installed on one machine, and but I'm just so protective of this environment that I, you know, have in front of me that,
oh, sure,
you know, it's you know, you become so cautious on doing any upgrade. I mean, I'm close to pulling the trigger on the second machine. Otherwise, I'm surrounded by, you know, Macs, which, you know, that's here or there, but it is an interesting move. I had one of my buddies who's a developer take the plunge on Windows 8, and he doesn't develop for Windows at all. He's a PHP, and he works web stuff. And I was like, you know, are you crazy? He said, oh no, I wanted to see what this does. And I, you know, I haven't talked to him where he's screaming at the top of his lungs and cussing out the system. So apparently that has worked out for him. So,
Todd, that's the same story that I'm hearing too. And I actually just, I upgraded my home theater PC to Windows 8, and it's working great. And I also went out and bought a new, touch laptop. So, and I've been playing around with that, and, so far I'm pretty happy with it. It actually does absolutely everything that I'm needing it to do. So I'm in, and it actually just looks really cool. I mean, I have to say the performance and how it works is fine. I think it's going to be a slow adoption, but I think it's going to get there. I think people just need to give it a try and start talking positively about it, and I think people will start adopting it, right?
You know, having converted the laptop over, I don't use that laptop as heavily as I do the desktop. So I basically went through and counted, okay, how many programs do I really use on a week-to-week basis? And it really came up to be about 20 or 25, and I'm probably on the extreme for a number of programs I'm using on a weekly basis. But a lot of it was Adobe stuff, Photoshop, video editing, that type of stuff. So I went through and counted because, you know, I'm loaded. I look at my program bar, excuse me, and stuff that I've collected over the years. And there's just tons of stuff that I use once in a while. And my worry was, you know, the way this is all set up, you got to put those favorites, the stuff that you're always using, on the desktop, or it doesn't really make it worth using. And so, you know, that was kind of my, so I'm still a little bit leery about making the jump because, you know, I'm always in folders and documents and it's, you know, I don't know. I think Windows 8 is great, but I wish they wouldn't have took away the start button. You know, that is my, it's perfect except for that, but I guess I could put an add on, you know, but,
yeah, I think I struggle with that too at the beginning, and then I found my workarounds to be able to get to those things, and then you just create your shortcuts and you're good to go.
Yeah.
So.
Well, yeah. I guess we'll see over time.
Yeah, I agree. Something different needs to happen on the desktop side. I'm not quite sure what it is. If it's the start menu or if it's just some sort of a hidden little tab that you can target or something. I'm not quite sure.
And what I find still is pretty clumsy is switching between programs. That's the most clumsy thing, I think, is, you know, I work in between a spreadsheet and a document, and, you know, it's just that back and forth seems to be a little bit clumsy. But other than that, you know, it's pretty good. Hey, I was, you know, this past week's been kind of slow. Obviously, on the news side, everyone's, you know, no one's got work on the mind. They got going home and enjoying Christmas on the mind. And so I was digging around and looking for some stuff to talk about this morning. And one of the things that came up, you know, that kind of went under the radar on a lot of sites was talking about the BlackBerry earnings and where they're at. But they say that they've had 1 million users desert, not as in desert eat, but as in desert the platform. And of course, with that, they've had a huge revenues drop by 48%. In the third quarter, although they did squeak out some money that I guess they did earn, which is incredible considering that many people bounce. But, you know, here's a question. Should we put BlackBerry, and I think I asked this question once before in the past, should we put BlackBerry on Death Watch, or do they have a chance in coming back?
Wow. It's a tough one because this is the first time they've shed any customers, and they still have somewhere close to 80 million customers, I believe, 80 million subscribers. It's some fairly large number. So a tough call. I mean, BlackBerry for me has been on the decline for a long time. So I'm actually surprised they didn't lose more customers, frankly, given how long we have been waiting for the next version of their operating system and the phones that will accompany it and so forth. So I don't know. They just seem to be on the long slide.
Yeah. And, you know, and I don't, everywhere I go, I don't know who these customers are. I think what people have done is companies say, here's your BlackBerry. And the employee sticks it in his pocket and says, oh, thanks. And he uses their iPad or their Android or whatever, the iPhone. And the BlackBerry comes out at the last resort. You know, I'm on airplanes and I just don't see BlackBerry's come out at all. So to me, that's always kind of an indication of, you know, when was the last time you guys saw somebody whip out a BlackBerry?
Well, Todd, from what I've seen in the numbers, the BlackBerry adoption was still pretty strong over in Europe. And I don't know if the Asian market was included in that, but it could just be that those folks haven't upgraded yet or updated their phones yet. I'm not quite sure, but it seems like those are the markets where the BlackBerry still has larger market share. They've lost a lot of market share here in the U.S., that's for sure. And I think Windows Phone just this past quarter just crossed over and surpassed them. So I think the Windows Phone side is at 7%, I think. Paul, is that accurate?
I don't actually think it's that high, but I
really okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big quarter for Windows Phone is going to be this current quarter, which we don't know about yet, and we'll see how the initial wave of Windows Phone 8 phones did in the market. And I suspect they did much, much better than Windows Phone 7, 5 phones did last year. So we'll have to wait and see. But I want to say they're closer to 3-4%.
Okay.
Or were in the previous quarter anyway.
You know, another thing that I've been seeing over the past couple of weeks, and you guys have too, is this ongoing escalation in battles between, you know, you had Instagram start off by basically, cutting its ties with Twitter, and there was a little quid pro quo there. And then Google made a big announcement and basically chopped the feet out from underneath Microsoft with the drop of support of ActiveSync. Is this just like people, are the wagons being circled? You know, here's the thing, it really pisses me off, to be honest with you. You know, when we started, when the web, you know, and this goes back to a piece that Ano Dash wrote 13th or something like that. I don't know if you guys saw it, The Web We Lost.
No, I did. Yeah,
and,
saw that.
You know, it just goes along that same theme of what he wrote, is that all of a sudden, you know, these companies are now, they're verticalizing everything, and they're forcing us into these, in these closed ecosystems. And, you know, we as users want interfunctionality, interoperability. We want these sites to cooperate. It's no doubt that people spend a lot of time on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, you know, all these sites. My daughter's an Instagram fanatic, and she's not a Twitter fanatic yet. But as soon as she gets old enough to kind of figure out the power of that, she's going to be like, how come I can't send my pictures? You know, so.
Yeah.
So I have a problem with the strategy because it's anti-user. You know, I think users want integration. They want the ability to access the services they want in the way that they want. And that just looking at email, obviously, if your mobile device, whatever it is, an iPhone, an Android phone, a Windows phone, has some really nice, high quality, mature email client, you want to be able to access all of your email accounts, wherever they're from, in that one account and one app rather, and have some single interface for doing so. And the Google strategy here is clearly to support their own mobile apps, which unfortunately for Windows users only run on Android and iOS. And so the apps are beautiful. There's no doubt about it, but it also promotes this kind of siloed effect where you have to think not about email, but about Gmail. You know, they don't want you to think mail from all your accounts in one place. They want you to think about Gmail. It's kind of a slippery slope.
It is. And, you know, it goes back to a whole bigger thing that, you know, I've harped on for years, is about, you know, having our place on the web. You know, Paul, you've got your site. Your site is like your lifeblood. It's probably what puts the food on your table. It's very, very critical, and I understand that we have to reach out to users that are on Facebook and Google Plus and have to engage those folks where they usually are and hopefully bring them back to the main property, get them subscribed, and, you know, all the things that go along with the reader and listener retainment. But, you know, it just, you know, most people, you know, the analogy I use is I grew up in a very small town. My graduating class was like 96 people. And everyone, you knew everyone in the high school by name, and you usually knew every parent. And so that community is very close, very tight-knit. You can rely on people. You still have to lock your doors at night, but, you know, if you have an issue, they come and, you know, they help you out. But a lot of those community members, and I'm not saying that this is bad, but I'm just saying it's just a fact of life of rural America, as many of those folks don't get out and too far from the nest. You know, they maybe go 50, 60, mm-hmm. 75, 100 miles, or do a once or two a lifetime trip somewhere, you know, maybe if they got lucky, to Hawaii or someplace like that. But their sphere of understanding of the world is really this crystal ball that is in and around that community. And I think we've expanded a lot with the internet, and that's opened up boundaries in itself. But here we have people that, my mom is on Facebook all day. She's here visiting. The page does not leave Facebook. And I'm like, how long has it been since you've been out and looked at other sites? Oh, I hang out on Facebook. So we've got this society now of internet users. That's all they know. And they never leave those pages. So are we, because of this strategy of these companies to silo us into sites, are we in danger of losing everything that the web really portrayed before us, openness and sharing of info?
Well, Todd, I think we've seen this movie before, so I think that there's some lessons from the past that can be applied here. I think, you know, if you think about the early days of the dot-com kind of boom, and a site called AOL was very, very, very much like this. I mean, and I think what it really reflects is that there is a significant percentage of our population that that likes the safety and comfort of having a controlled experience, right? That's got everything that they need all in one place, and it's simple and easy, and they can get in and out, or they can spend hours in, right? And they're confident that, that that's where their friends are and the people like that they want to have contact with, or if they want to expand their network. And that's what a large percentage of the population is looking for. And I don't think that they necessarily really care whether or not it's part of an open strategy. If I think about my early days of use of the web and when I got first involved in it, it was really a grand adventure, right? I mean, the web and the World Wide Web was cool because I felt like I could go to different places in the world and I could experience different sites and I could see pictures, and it was all, you know, this new wonderful world, right? But as that kind of wore out a little bit, I think the tendency is that people start getting very pragmatic about how they use the internet and want to use it to solve problems. And that's how we kind of get into this vortex of wanting to only use certain services that cater to our needs or our psychological or our practical and logistical needs. And I think that that's how we've gotten here. So I guess the question that we need to ask ourselves and kind of talk about here is, what does the web need to become in its next version that will attract us back into an open end where people feel like they can be a little bit of adventurous and not be so concerned about having a controlled environment?
Do you think it's more about the tech guys taking back control? But if, you know, once the tech guys try to put their influence back on, there's the financial piece that's going to come on, and it's just self-replicating. You want to keep people there.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot of business benefits to having a large group of users using a controlled platform, and this is definitely an example of that, and that's what all these companies are fighting for. That's what they're getting their investment from VCs is to aggregate audiences, and that creates this concern that we have, is that people are just not being adventurous. And
well,
yeah,
at least on the internet, I mean, the advantage is other things can happen. If you think about something like TV, it is dominated by it is only really professional companies making high quality productions, at least if not content. You know, even if most people on the web are visiting, you know, Facebook and Google and a handful of other services, the chance always remains that someone could come along as an individual or small company, startup, whatever, and create some incredible new service that people gravitate to very quickly. You know, so the internet at least is not set in stone in the same way that basically the, you know, TV networks or cable is sort of set in stone, in the sense that individuals don't have a chance to impact it. And these things can change. I mean, it's hard not to look at Facebook and think that we're looking at the next version of AOL. And in that sense, we certainly have seen this story before. But, you know, Facebook displaced MySpace, and it's possible that something coming down the line may displace Facebook as well. And I think that's the hope, at least, of the internet, that that type of thing can happen.
I think we want it to continue to happen, you know, because I can't imagine spending the next 25 years on Facebook.
Actually, I kind of can't imagine it, but it would be like the Matrix, where you're kind of suckled onto a giant viral network that with no chance of escaping.
This is,
well,
Kent.
I think that the other part of this is Google Plus, right? Is that the next up and coming platform for the exact same thing? Or, you know, are users just going to skip between these closed networks, you know? Right?
Because it's just the same thing with a Google logo on it, you know. The thing that I like, I will say this for Facebook, regardless of its murky origins, it does solve a problem, or at least provide a solution, in that it allows me to keep up with people that I care about that I don't see a lot in ways that were never possible in the past. I used to see cousins and aunts and uncles and people like that at family reunions, you know, once every several years at best, and you'd kind of catch up and marvel at how big the kids had gotten. And now I get to see that happening in real time over Facebook, which is beautiful. The problem I have with Google Plus is just that it's Google reacting to Facebook and doing the same thing. It's not some innovative new thing. It's a reaction. It's just, you know, Facebook 2.0 or whatever. So I'm hoping that, you know, whatever displaces Facebook, if something does, whether it's Facebook itself innovating again or just something new and different, is something that is in fact new and different, not just something that's just another big company taking a stab at exactly the same thing.
You know, I think I find family, friends, and fans on Facebook, and I find geeks on Google Plus. You know, so it's for me, it's two different audiences, and obviously the topics are, you know, constructed differently. And those, you're not hearing them, you know, going to the dentist with the kids or something on Gmail.
Well, Todd, and that's kind of a clue. I mean, if you think about the history of the adoption of these kind of platforms, it's typically led by the geeks,
right?
And then it moves into the masses, right? I mean, it takes a couple of years. It's the same thing happened to Twitter. It's the same thing that I think somewhat happened to Facebook, even though Facebook had a very different beginning. I mean, it was targeting towards young people in college, and then it branched out to high school a little bit. It didn't find its way too well on the high school side. So it had a different kind of beginning, and I wonder if that type of phenomenon is going to have a similar beginning with young people for the next wave, right? And maybe there's some social network that's starting to bubble out there that we're not even aware of because we're older, right? That is going to ramp up here over the next few years. And I think it might be an interesting thing is to ask our kids and find out what they're gravitating towards on a minority of their time, because I get a sense that younger kids are like, oh, Facebook is where my mom is and where, you know, my grandmother is. And I don't want to hang out there anymore. I want to hang out in some community that's more targeted towards the same age group.
You know, I got a 22-year-old that is in Florida, and she's on different networks. Well, she's on Facebook, but she's also hanging out other places. And then my 15-year-old and 16-year-old are, I kind of watch over their shoulders, see where they're at, and I can see different sites that they're on. But I got a 9-year-old that's driving me crazy. He's asking me every day for a Facebook account. And I said, no, you're not there yet. You know, I've got one reserved for him with his name and everything, but I am not going to let him have the logon until, you know, he's probably 12 or 13. And he can hang out, and if he wants to put a picture up, he can do it on my account. But you know, I don't know. It's an interesting move. You know, I'm racking my brain. You know, where's the next billion-dollar company? And of course, that's the billion-dollar question: is where do you go next? And you know, our team, we're going to meet in February, and we're going to talk about where we're at and what we're some things that we're going to do in the coming year. And I'm sure we're going to have some new ideas, but. You know, I am so convinced beyond this is where one industry that I think that is going to be large, and it's online education. And I'm more and more and more I think about it, the more I'm like thinking there's a business here, there's a business here, and it fits into the platform that we have and some things that we've built already. You know, I saw see if I can find it here real quick. I saw a post over on hackcollege.com that I talked about that came out on the 20th, and this is incredible, and this is going to raise significant eyebrows if this goes through. But the Florida legislature, who controls the purse strings to Florida public schools, public universities, are considering legislation that will force Florida public institutions to put every course they have online, forcing them to. I mean, basically saying you shall put all 700 of your existing online course and programs at the 39 public institutions that have get state funding in the state of Florida online. And part of it is that the state, the public universities in Florida, their costs are spiraling out of control. and they want a way to start making this more open and giving access. So, you know, of course, first thing that the university say is, oh, no, 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 we're not doing that. Because what happens? You go online and this whole ecosphere of tenured professors really goes out the window. Because, you know, if I was to start an online university, the whole challenge is the accreditation part. But all of a sudden, you know, let's do an economics class. You know, who do you bring in? Do you pay the Fed chief an honorarium to come in and teach Econ 101? Do you have a business class? Do you pay Bill Gates and, you know, people that are very successful that can teach these classes, come in and teach them? And then the whole dynamic of a college education, even though it can follow a curriculum, is going to change dramatically. I think there's already some, you know, companies trying to work this, but for a state to finally say you, and this isn't done yet by a long shot, this is just a bill that's going through, I think it's incredible. Can you imagine this, the board of governors at these online education, or these public universities, that's going after them. I couldn't agree more with
this is actually one of the more exciting things I think that's happening online right now. And obviously podcasts alone have an incredible amount of educational material on them. You can learn foreign languages, you can learn about history, whatever. There's all kinds of stuff like that. iTunes U that Apple has, absolutely incredible formal higher education classes with the curriculum and all the, you know, the paperwork and so forth that goes along with it. Really kind of amazing stuff. And then a lot of organizations that aren't associated with schools also having online learning sessions. I find this whole thing to be amazing. It's just absolutely amazing. Looking just at something like a foreign language, you can subscribe to services like Live Mocha. You can learn through a podcast. You can learn through classes at various colleges, through iTunes U. I mean, the sheer amount of educational material that's online in ways that are either formal or not is just so astonishing. And if I hit the lottery, I think I would spend the rest of my life just taking classes virtually and in person and just being amazed by the sheer variety of what's available. I wish I had the time to do more of that kind of stuff.
I was talking with a business owner recently, and this topic came up, and he said, you know, I'm seeing a lot of students walk through the door with non-traditional educations. And he says, so, you know, as an employer, he says, you know, I'm an open mind, and this guy comes through the door, and he may not have a bachelor's degree per se from a specific university, but he's out to have my folks write a test and do an interview and basically put practical stuff in front of these folks, and they're just killing it. They're knocking it out of the ballpark. And he says they might be a little rough around the edges and may not have some of those extra skills. But he says, you know, as a new worker, you don't need those new, you know, some of those extra, you know, things that they throw at you in school. And he says, we can train them here and mold them the way we want them. But the question I had for him was, okay, so if you had a guy that walked in the door with a bachelor's degree in computer science and had a guy that was self-taught, or he had a guy that went on and did an online education, and he said, you know, I'd probably want a little bit of the mix of the online and the, a little formal and a little of both. And I said, are you going to pay him an, you know, equivalent salary of a bachelor's degree? Because that's the big thing. You have to have a bachelor's degree or you're going to make $25,000 less, well, you know, a year. And I think that's true in a lot of businesses. You're not going to go to work for a bank probably without an MBA, but it is an interesting time, and I could see a lot of industries really being upset, turn over the apple cart and in their whole business perspective. But, one guy told me, he says, you know, really the bachelor's degree today is like a high school education. He says, it's the bare minimum. He says a master's degree today is the new bachelor's degree. And then he went against the argument that this other guy had made on, you know, I'm taking a lot more of a non-traditionally trained folks and making them students or making them employees.
So I wonder if we're going to see a day when a person can take all their coursework and get a fully accredited BBA or bachelor's degree by doing it all online. I'm not quite sure that we're there yet. I actually haven't been spending a lot of time investigating this.
I did.
Oh, really? Did
my entire degree path online.
Did you?
The whole thing. Now, I'm a special case, too, because I went to Emory-Riddle's Aeronautical University. They gave me, basically 2 years credit for basically 20 years of aviation experience. Mm. Okay. So I really only had to take 2 years of classes, but I still shelled out, $40,000, so it wasn't like it was free, I still spent the money, but I took, I never stepped in a classroom one, and it's harder. And I think another challenge it will have is my daughter who's 16, she would not survive in a non-traditional classroom setting.
Well, and that's the bigger question if I think about it too, is if you're going to be successful in getting an education in an online medium like that and basically essentially alone, it takes a lot of discipline to actually follow through on that. It's not like you're going to class at 9 a.m., to noon, every day, and you have kind of that social pressure to push you through it. Though it takes dedication to go to a regular college as well, but it just feels like it would be really easy to just kind of slack off on the online side.
And what we found, what I found talking, sharing crib notes with folks that were in the traditional class and me being online, it was much, much harder. Yeah. Now, here's the thing that was kind of odd. The tests were online. You could use the book if you were savvy enough to use the book, but the tests were timed. You had more questions, less time. So it's not like you could sit there and flip the book and find the answer. It just didn't work that way. You may have gotten one or two questions by the book, but and that's another thing too, is the testing, the practical stuff. They make you turn in more homework, more papers. So it's not so much tied to a midterm or final exam. And who knows, maybe proctoring centers will pop up all over the country and people will be coming in, and that'll be a business in itself where you do enough proctoring.
Wow.
Yeah, who knows? But that's getting off the path quite a bit here. But I just think what Florida's doing is what they're considering is incredible.
I find the whole notion that Florida would be leading the way educationally to be incredibly strange, but
yeah.
I certainly give them credit for that. I do think that the learn from home movement, as we might call this, is very similar to the work from home movement, where certain personality types can gravitate toward this type of thing and do very, very well, and some can't.
Yeah.
Obviously, anyone who comes in, especially a programmer type or some technical position, there should be some vetting process where you determine that this person knows what they're talking about and can, in fact, do the work. But I don't see any reason why going forward it should be this way. I mean, when I went to school, these types of things were not even a distant gleam in anyone's eye. They were, it was inconceivable.
Right.
Yeah.
So to me, again, this is just, it's amazing that this is even possible.
How do we train the HR people that are the people who have been in these positions for 20 years that
I know. They need to retire. Basically, I don't think they're going to be able to take it.
You know,
someone who's been in HR for 25 years is not going to look very kindly on this kind of thing.
They're going to take that. Oh, no degree. And it goes in the shit can. They didn't even look at it. You're automatically
which not is included. Ludicrous, because you're really leaving out a lot of probably highly talented people.
But LinkedIn, that's where we found all of our employees in the recent time. We've put job announcements in LinkedIn, and that's, we've scored some great people in LinkedIn. I tell you, you don't need to use those other job announcement services. Just, especially if you have a good connection in your LinkedIn site and you have a piece of people already found you as soon as you post a job announcement, it's incredible. I mean, we got inundated with really super qualified and overqualified people for job positions. So, yeah, Boomerang has something along this too. They're talking about now, a lot of states are starting to publish, here's a degree program you're going to get in, and this is what you're expected to earn. I think there should be more of this too, because, someone says, well, I want to be a history teacher. And I'm like, okay, you, when you leave, you're going to make $33,154 a year. Is that worth a $32,000 education? Yeah, no, or do you, you know, or do you want to, yeah. So.
Better interest than a passbook savings account.
That's true. Yeah, probably. Yeah, that's, God, yeah, that's for sure. So let's talk about Apple a little bit here. Apple patent used against Samsung is under fire. This patent used in the court case is basically on the verge of being shredded by PTO. So this could be huge. And it's this is all claims, all 21 claims of U.S. patent number 7,844,915, also known as the pinch and zoom patent, were rejected by the patent office today following a re-examination.
I feel like I misunderstood something with the story because reading about the rejection, it suggests that Apple's patent wasn't a patent. It was a patent application. And now I'm wondering how it's possible that a company with patent applications was able to secure a $1.05 billion verdict against a company that was allegedly infringing on those non-existent patents. So am I right. missing that? Or were these, in fact, patents that were granted and they've only been re-examined?
I think what happened was is they were patents that were granted. And then okay. you, if when a patent is granted, you have the right, if you have the cash... Mm-hmm. to go in there and say, hold up, we're contesting this. And basically, yep. you submit documentation saying why there is either prior art or whatever. And
so, I mean, why would they rule? Why would this even, you know, in all the things that are broken in this system, how is it that a jury could rule against the company when that examination has not occurred?
Well, I,
you know, since this verdict, two of the six patents involved in this trial have been invalidated.
I think what it is they were a patent by law, technically, mm-hmm. even though a review was under process, they were still technically Apple's patent. So that's probably. I'm not a lawyer.
Anybody else but me? Oh, I'm just amazed by that. I pinched to zoom.
Yeah.
Not patented by Apple. You know, that was the linchpin of this case.
Yeah, it was. And
they won $1 billion.
So
I'm not saying that Samsung didn't rip off Apple. I mean, wholesale, obviously they did. But, you know, I guess what it comes down to is the actual legal battle, which involves very specific patents, which we're now learning Apple doesn't rightfully own.
Samsung is, of course, not happy. And basically, Samsung pointed this out in a filing to U.S. District Court Judge Lucy Koh. This action, this is on CNET, noting that it was relevant given the company's effort to retrial, as well as Apple's attempt and an injunction against a number of Samsung devices for the infringing on this very patent. So basically, Samsung say, hey, they don't have the patent anymore, or it's under, you know, so don't take my product off the street.
Well, I mean, you can bring any complaint to the litigation process. I mean, that's been going on with divorce court for years, is people just make all sorts of accusations against other people. Then it's up to the judge to make the determination. So, you know, that could be a factor here too. Apple had some little sliver of opportunity here and they jumped on it to push the envelope. I mean, irregardless if it was really legitimate or not.
Well, Apple obviously has a chance now during this reexamination to address those prior art or whatever the claim was, that there wasn't a claim. I'm going to tell you can spend a lot of money on patent stuff. When we started Raw Voice, we came up with a really cool idea. And at the time, no one else was doing it. And it was something involving RSS. And the way we were manipulating RSS. I said, that's patentable. I said, no one else is doing it. No one else has it. Let's go ahead and write it up. And we did, not using a lawyer and not using, we just did it ourselves and really not having too much of a clue on what we were doing, submitted it. And it really got quite a ways into the look, and then the patent office said, hey, knuckleheads, here's something and here's something. And, you know, we looked at the what they referenced, and it was close, but not the same. And it was a different type of an application. And I could say, okay, we're still good because it's really, this is not relevant. And so, but I said, before I go and spend more time on this, let me retain a patent attorney. Let's have them look at this and say whether or not it's worth our time to go forward. So, and I paid some patent attorney $5,000 to review our, you know, our rejected patent application. And he says, hey, you know, I can, we can go down this road. We can spend $25,000 and go through the whole process. And in the end, you know, you got a 50-50 chance on whether this is going to get approved. And I'm like, okay, thanks for being honest with me. Here's your, we'll write you a check for your services. And, you know, and we abandoned the patent application. So, you know, and it's still in my mind, we had a valid patent, but was I worth, was it worth to me to spend $30,000 on the, and all we here's what the funny thing, we're trying to protect that functionality from the vultures. That was our pure purpose. We weren't going to do enforcement. We just wanted to protect that system that we had designed from vultures coming in and trying to demand money. You know, like they're doing in so many of these court cases today, saying, oh, I own the patent on that. You have to write me a royalty check. So it wasn't even for, we weren't even looking at it from a cash benefit standpoint. So I think the whole patent system from a software standpoint is just broke.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I couldn't agree more.
But yeah, they, you know, Samsung may end up not having to pay a dime on this except pay their lawyers. That's who gets rich, is the lawyers.
You know, I suppose if the one good thing that comes out of this is that these companies start talking and cross license and this kind of thing dies down, then I'm not saying it was all worth it, but that would be not a horrible outcome. You know, I think that there's kind of a sue your competitor mania occurring now, especially in the mobile industry, that is just taking the conversation away from where it should be, which is on the products and the services and so forth that these companies mm-hmm. are offering. You know, I just... Yeah, this is such a sideshow.
Yeah, I think all these companies need to be competing in the marketplace and not in the courtroom as much.
It's an epidemic in this country. Companies won't talk; they litigate. Congress won't talk; they just fight.
I was just thinking that. Yeah, it's like politics. Yeah.
No one talks anymore. It's all they're all for blood in the bottom line. And what it is you got, you know, heavy pressures by companies to basically come out with their SEC filings and say we made more money. We had higher margins. You know, our cost of business was lower. You know, they've got all these efficiency things that go into the stock price, and it's the stock market's fault. You know, and it's just the system we have. But you know, they look at how they're beating up Apple on their stock price. The company's making money hand over foot, but because they're not making more money. You know, okay, we're going to take their stock down $100. Okay, that's the way it works. But it to me, it's just like, wow, you know?
Yeah, I think that the big reason that the share price is down, well, there's a couple reasons, but I think that the analysts felt that when they launched the iPad mini, that eroded the regular iPod sales, which cut down on their margins. And then also, there's just a lot of investors that are pulling money out because they think that their tax rates are going to go up for 2013.
Oh, they are.
I mean, it's really that simple.
My accountant has already sent me a letter warning me, and he sent me this year, next year, and it's a big number. And, you know, it's I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to live without that, you know, that extra stack of green. That green, it's not going to be there
that
anymore.
You might have otherwise owned.
Yeah, and you know, he was, you know, he passed, okay, if you've got something here, you know, basically what he's saying is, you know, looking at where we're at in your tax year, don't spend no money this year. You know, if you've got major expenses, hold up to January 1st before you buy anything big, because we're going to need to find a way to lower your income this year or the following next year. So I'm thinking to myself, great, just when I get everything done, I don't need to buy anything, you know, and now it's, you know, so anyway, long story short, it's good to be in this position. I'm not complaining. because I could be unemployed and looking for a job. So not bitching at all. But at the same point, you know, I think everyone's going to be in for a shock. Let's get away from a topic that's going to piss us all off. And let's talk about Time Warner Cable, which may make us all more mad. As a thank you to customers, Time Warner Cable's most popular internet service, the company is boosting the maximum download speeds for standard internet by 50% from 10 megs to 15 for customers throughout its New York City service area. So let me
all
think.
All the way up to 15, huh?
So let me think. You know, for years, I'm sitting in here in Hawaii, and I've got 3 megs down, and I've got 256K up. Then at some point, they raise it to 5 megs down, 512 up. So that's where it stayed for years and years and years and years. And as soon as our local telecom says, hey, folks, we're going to start offering a brand new package where you're going to get 12 down, 2 up. It's going to be cheaper than Time Warner. Within days of that announcement, I get an email from Time Warner says, by the way, we're offering new services. We're offering a 25 meg down, 1 meg up tier, and we're offering a 50 meg down, 2 meg up tier. Would you like to upgrade? See here, let me think. Monopoly or competition? What's better, monopoly or competition?
Now I know where this is going. Yeah, I mean that's the problem that I have here in the Seattle area is that it's the only option you have really is Comcast. So they can jerk you around as much as they want, and they can, you know, I mean obviously we need competition. You know, this whole Google Fiber thing and municipal broadband is something that needs to be developed.
Well, I mean, municipal broadband's outlawed in some states.
Yeah, well, and you know who pushed for that, right?
Well, let me think. Time Warner, Comcast. So, you know. Yeah.
This thing is clearly as crucial as electricity. It should be delivered in exactly the same fashion and subject to the same universal availability.
Paul, you don't live in Hawaii.
No.
Do you have a choice of your electricity provider?
I do. Oh. I have several choices. Oh, man. Oh, not of electricity. Really? I'm sorry. Sorry. Yeah. Not of electricity. No. I'm sorry.
But I bet you don't pay 36 cents a kilowatt.
Actually,
No.
When I turn the studio on, I know that it is costing me $1.75 an hour. When everything's on and running.
Does it actually make a cash register ching sound when you do that?
No, but what it does is when the show's over, my wife comes and says, Are you going to shut that off? You're going to turn this off? Well, how come that's still on? How come I'm hearing a fan run?
But Todd, that's why you have all those little remote controls you can walk around.
Yep,
and push, right?
Everything. Yep.
Ka-ching, 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 ka-ching.
I want to share with you guys something too. Have you guys bought a new computer anytime soon, especially a desktop or maybe something a little more high end?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I bought a desktop computer this year.
Okay. Was it?
No, I didn't.
Is it?
No.
Does it? Will it do gaming? Is it that high enough to do gaming? That kind of stuff.
Yep.
Does it have a PFS power supply in it?
I don't know. How would I know?
You probably won't. Does that machine ever reboot on demand? Just all of a sudden just reboots?
No.
Well, during my 24-hour podcast, I had 4 TriCaster.
Not 24 hours in a row, apparently.
it was in like four hour segments. We were on 24 hours. My TriCaster.
Yeah, he actually did 24 hours. Yeah.
my TriCaster was just rebooting. And couldn't figure out why. Mm-hmm. And I called New Tech and I said, listen, my $30,000 TriCaster is rebooting. Well, during a live show, what the hell is going on? They say, what kind of a UPS are you using? And I read off the model number and they said, you know that machine has a PFS power supply. And I'm like, okay. She says, you know that you need a pure sine wave UPS for that machine. I'm like, was that an instruction manual? And she goes, yeah, page 218, subparagraph 26 or whatever it was. And so here's just a little tip for you. If you ever have a computer that just is, you know, it's like someone hit the reset button and rebooting, you're going to want to look at the UPS you have and make sure you have a pure sine wave UPS. So I am now the new proud owner of two CyberPower UPSs that do pure sine wave. And, well, I'm holding, I don't want to hold my breath here, but it hasn't rebooted in 2 days. So, I'm thinking, okay, so our computers are getting smarter and our UPSs are getting dumber. So now what does that mean? We're going to have to buy more expensive, because you're not buying a pure sine wave UPS for anything less than about $200. You know, that's about the bottom that they go. And when you get it and you pick it up, you'll know, say, like, wow, this thing is heavier. And the thing that even more sucks is when you have a standard UPS, you get a power efficiency of about 85-87% is the power efficiency on a standard UPS. But when you get a pure sine wave UPS, the power efficiency is about 60%. So it really costs you more to have the thing plugged into the wall than what it would a normal UPS. So, yeah. So, you know, that is another thing that I'm like, okay, you learn something new every day. But I thought I would, for the, you know, geek out of here a little bit and tell you guys about that.
So, Todd, are they using lithium-ion batteries in those UPSs now? Do you know?
All I know is the battery, the UPS I bought, which is their OR2200 PFC CRT2U, was 70 pounds.
Yeah.
And because I have I have a couple of machines here that are running those type of power supplies, I said, okay, if I'm going to do it, let's do it big. And I probably spent a little more money than I needed to, but you got a $30,000 box, and you know what's $500 to spend on a super high quality, you know, power regulation system for it. So I don't think it's, I don't know what it's got in it. I think it's just heavy.
I don't think it's metal or lithium ion.
Probably, no, probably not for $500.
Way too expensive.
Probably. Yeah, and this thing's got like a 59-minute runtime or something like that. So it's, you know, it's incredible. All right, let me switch gears here. But the thing is, everything had been fine for years. But I think what it was is I'd had so much gear on, and then I was asking my wife, "Were you doing like laundry or running the dishwasher?" I'm like, "Yeah, we're doing like normal stuff during the day, and I'm usually not running this gear at hours that other stuff is going on in the house." Now, I'd had extra circuits already dropped in, and called my electrician when I ordered this thing and say, "Hey, I'm bringing in a box that needs a special plug because it's a 20-amp circuit." And he kind of laughed. He says, "You know," he says, "when I dropped that line in there," he says, "looking at all the stuff you had in there and your tenacity to add stuff," he says, I ran a line that will support 20 amps. Let me come down, change out the circuit breaker and change out the plug, because it's got one of those, you ever seen one of those plugs that has a T in it?
Mm-hmm.
So it has one of those types of plugs. But anyway, long story short, it is what it is. So Facebook yesterday released Poke for mobile. Have you guys installed this yet?
No, because I do not use an iPhone.
Aha.
And I don't either, so no.
Yeah.
I was at Buca di Beppo a couple of days ago, and I checked in with Foursquare. It had been there twice in a month, and I became the mayor, which shocked me. So, you know, is this, of all places to get a mayorship, is Buca di Beppo. So the question is this Facebook's, are they going after Foursquare and Yelp and all those folks? Is this their solution to that? Have you guys read up on this at all?
No, but I'm sure they are. Yeah. They're trying to keep everybody inside their ecosystem, you know.
I actually think they were already competing and even beating Foursquare, to be honest, because as I said earlier, you actually use Facebook a lot, and I check in on Facebook a lot, and I know other people do as well. And this is maybe a more formalized way of doing it, but they always, not always, but for a long time have kind of had this functionality already. So I think they're just moving even further in that direction.
Well, it's we'll see where it goes. And just kind of, you know, you'll have three or four Facebook apps on your phone instead of just one.
Yeah.
Hey, Apple, there was a company that did a Kickstarter, And they announced Thursday that they were shutting down. And basically because they weren't able to get it's basically the pop charger. I don't know if you guys have seen this or not.
Yep.
They basically Apple told them, no, you can't intermix a 30 pin connector with the new, you know, their new plug. And the Kickstarter folks said, okay, we're going to give everybody their money back. And before they could do that, the folks at Apple said, well, we've changed our mind. So they've lifted the block on the combo 30-pin and lightning charging accessories. They're going to let them to coexist with this pop charger. And I just wondered if Apple did a little PR repair here. I wondered if they decided that maybe we're going to get a little bit negative press and people are going to be bitching that we can't have, you know, this doesn't make eco sense. Or maybe this a green decision? I don't know. What do you guys think? Was this more political than anything else?
No, I think they just, honestly, this company had uncovered, a problem with their licensing terms, and they adjusted it to adapt, pardon the pun, to power supplies specifically. Because obviously what Apple's trying to do is push this new connector type, which is fine. But this company wanted to do what is basically a single power supply for multiple devices using multiple types of connectors. And so Apple adjusted their terms to allow for that. It was the right thing to do, you know. So on that note, I'm shocked that Apple did it, but it's nice. It's the right thing to do for customers.
Yeah. No, I think it makes perfect sense too. There's a lot of people out there that have older Apple devices that still need to plug them in. So.
Yeah.
Two Kickstarters I participated in this year have come to fruition. I worked. I kickstarted on the Connectify plan where, and I don't know if you're familiar with what Connectify has done. They've come out with a new version of their Wi-Fi wireless sharing. And basically now you can plug in multiple connections to a single machine and then it will basically packet up the data and send it to whatever connection is the best or conglomerate it or something. Been playing with it quite a bit because I'm really looking to see how to maximize my bandwidth at CES, because you know that we're going to have everything is there's no going to be no data, you know, basically after Tuesday the data evaporates and you're lucky to get a text message out. So I've been playing with that. It's not too bad, but the one I'm really excited about, the one that I probably spent the most money on, I did a $175 donation to Watt Vision. And it was really at a time when my wife was pounding on me for the $500 electricity bills that were arriving at the house and to no fault of my own, we were still using the same kilowatt amount, just that they went crazy on rate increases when after the Japan tsunami and Japan started using the same type of oil that our generators use here for our non-green electricity generation in Hawaii. So what this does, and I don't know if you guys are familiar with this at all, but it's a sensor that you actually put, and I tell you, I'm sure the electricity company is going to flip out when they see this, but it's a sensor that you put on the front or to the side of your meter, and this ties to a module that's connected to the internet, that's connected to an application that tells you moment by moment, hour by hour, how much energy you're using. And it makes a dumb home smart when it comes to electricity consumption. Now, if you've got one of those digital meters, they've got solutions for that as well. They've got a huge number. But I have one of the old school meters that still has the five little meters across it. And they wanted a picture of my meter to know which module to send to me. I'm so excited to get this thing. I'm about jumping out of my skin. I can't wait till it gets here. And I don't know, Seattle or where you live, if they've made improvements, are you guys able to monitor what's going on with your home on a day-to-day basis? But this, to me, I think is going to be very cool because I'm going to be able to see exactly where we're using energy and how and when. And I have a pretty good idea already, but this is going to give me a breakdown that's really, really tight. Is this kind of stuff excite you guys?
Well, yeah, I definitely want to be able to have a better snapshot of where my you know, where my electricity consumption is, so I can make adjustments to it. So this tracker will just track your kind of your overall usage pattern. It doesn't track it by outlet or device or anything like that.
I don't know if you guys can see that in the video feedback or not. It's probably pretty small.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, but it's basically, it goes right on the front of your meter. So this tracks overall. It doesn't do outlet by outlet. Okay. Yeah.
So it's not like a kilowatt type device where you're measuring what a particular device is doing.
Right. This is basically, it shows your mass consumption on your basically mm-hmm. your entire household. And for me, just by our lifestyle and how we live and how we work and everything else, I'm going to be able to, you know, the thing I'm going to be able to do is I'm going to show my wife, see, on Saturday when you did the laundry and didn't hang it out instead of running it in the dryer, it cost us $8. And, you know, so this is the kind of thing that from a husband.
You're going to use it as a weapon.
And she's and believe me, it'll be vice versa. It'll work the other way, too. Because you see, oh, on Monday night and Thursday night, you see the power peaked for 5 hours while you had the studio up. That costs, you know, that costs $6 or whatever it costs. So, you know, we're going to know how we're using our energy. And I think really what it's going to do is most people that are using this already saying they're seeing 20 to 25% efficiencies in their electricity usage because they realize, okay, you know, I'm burning, you know, $8 electricity while I'm not even home during the day because I've left every one of these phantom chargers turned on or whatever it may be, or all of a sudden my electricity spiked and my refrigerator is on the blink. You know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that you'll never know. We're on solar hot water heater here. So every morning that like when my mom's here, we burn, you wake up in the morning and it's cold. So I've had to reset the timer up now so that it doesn't get completely cold. I hit it a couple of times with electricity in the evening to keep the heat level up without it being going ice cold, and then really cost me a lot of money while she's here to keep the. So when she's not here, you in the summertime, my hot water tank never gets turned on ever. You know, because the solar basically.
I don't want to spend too much time on the hot tub that I leave running 365 days a year, but I suspect I pay a lot less for electricity than you do.
And you're probably your $40 or $45 bill for your hot tub, you know, would be $160 for me. So
that's crazy. It's really expensive.
Yeah, or three. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I would love to have each of my power. Power plugs in my wall have a wireless transmitter that will transmit the usage of electricity through my Wi-Fi network to some app or something like that. I would love to be able to track it by
control
outlet.
Them so that they're either on a schedule or that you can say, you know, it's time to go off. You know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's where we need to get to is to be able to track by outlet and then go into software and set up that outlet to be, well, what kind of appliance is sitting on this outlet in the far corner of the living room or something like that, or in my office or something like that. And then also be able to trace it back to each of the devices that's plugged into that outlet too. So, but it feels like we're kind of a long ways away from that.
Let me show you guys something. The studio's power is controlled by 4 remote controls.
Uh-huh.
So when it comes time to shut the studio down, I basically hit the off button 4 times, and it takes everything in the studio off power except for my main computer and monitor. And basically, you know, I spent the money on those green switches so that I could shut this studio down. But I have these everywhere in my house. If not this kind, they're on push buttons. That basically having a transformer plugged into an outlet here has been outlawed because I just, you know, I'm at this point, I'm the worst. I tell you what, you know how your dad was, turn the lights off. Why you leave that light on? I'm worse. I'm like a Nazi around here.
It sounds like you have to be though.
Well, it's a difference between $360 a month or $500 a month.
Yeah.
You know, so it's really that much difference in the amount of cost. But anyway, I'm looking forward to CES too. I'm hoping that some companies are going to come out with like the type of product Rob's talking about. And I'm going to be like, send me 30, you know, and I'll change every outlet in the house. And we'll really get hardcore. All right. And what'd be cool too is have be able to turn the bottom one on and leave the top one off or something to that effect too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that way I can really control the Xbox usage. And, you know, I'm not home. The kids come home latchkey and all of a sudden by remote, I'm like, and that the outlet goes off, you know? So, yeah. So let's talk about the Instagram total. Oh man. Did they fail this week or what?
Yep.
It's, you know,
if it wasn't for Netflix, this would have been the high tech PR disaster of the year, I guess. But it seems like they just reversed course and did the right thing. So,
well, you know, and I read through the terms of service, and I'm not a big photographer, but you know, I my daughter, who's really, she could care less about a terms of service. And a terms of service is like, you know, click pass, don't even pay attention. So I said to her, and I. Someone had posted like the four things that people were freaking out on. And I brought her in here and I said, okay, now listen to this. Do you like this? Oh, they could make me I could be in an ad on Instagram. Oh, that's so cool. And you know, so it's for her.
It's a different way of looking at it.
There was and she's like, and I'm trying to be like to run the scientific experiment thing. I'm going to have good stuff to tell on my show. My daughter was outraged about the Instagrams of terms of service. Could care less. So she's 16, so I'm going to put her in the 16 to 25 graphic. I'm going to say they didn't care. Who cared? Who was the ones that really cared? Was it the professional photographers? Were they the ones that flipped out?
I would be anyone who was an adult. I mean, you know, parents with kids who could potentially be used in an ad that maybe a friend of theirs would see through Facebook, which would be a little weird. I mean, anyone who cares about privacy at all should be concerned about this. Or should.
Well, actually, I was like, my takeaway from it was like, they got penalized for being honest about what they were going to do.
True.
I mean, yeah. their terms of service left this open anyway. I mean, the original terms of service left this capability, you know, actually gave them more capability to use these pictures based on the old one. So when they basically narrowed the definition in the terms of service, that was actually a good thing. So at least they were being honest about what they were doing. And now they get slapped, and now they're going to go back to more broad terms of service, which leaves even more opportunity for them to do stuff. So I kind of have mixed feelings about what happened here. I think we slapped the company for being more narrow in how they were kind of telling us what they were going to do with the photos. So anyway, that's my comment on it. And I think it definitely doesn't move us forward. It actually moves us backwards.
The folks at The Verge say, well, what this is going to create is going to force companies to be more shadier. You know.
Well, yeah, because they're going to create these terms of services, you know, that are more broad, right? Which is what they've been doing all along, right? So I would prefer that they get more specific on what they're doing in their terms of service and not keep everything so broad.
It's, you know, we've had a terms of service over at Raw Voice, and one of the clauses that is really the one that really that gets people's pissed off, the one that comes up the most often, that if we have a client leave us. And I had a show that basically emailed me a couple of days ago and said, hey, Todd, we're leaving Tech Podcast. And I, quite frankly, I didn't even know the show had been part of Tech Podcast. We'd approved them some time ago and they never participated. And I'm like, oh, okay. But as you just remember, because sometimes shows leave us when they are being approached by our own advertisers. I'll say, remember, clause 5B or whatever it is, you cannot, you're banned or prevented or you're excluded from taking advertising from any of our vendors from 1 year. And I provided the link that we provide in the terms of service that shows that current list. And I emailed that back to him. And because we're very careful in our terms of service. We make people put a little check mark there saying, yes, I understand that. So I said, just remember, it's cool. Yeah, we're glad to have had you. Thanks for being part of the community. We'll take you off the site. And just remember, and that can't, what do you mean I can't take advertising from any of these vendors from a year? I'm like, well, you know, because I have a business and you agreed to it. And if you go and do a deal with them separately, that's money out of my pocket. It's not fair. We've helped promote you. You know, get, you know, all this other stuff, and you've had it available. These dad deals have been available to you separately. So that's the thing that we see. And I, that's, you know, it's always the, that's really a big conflict. But, and people say, why do you do that? I got employees I got to feed, you know, it's or pay. So I understand why companies do some things in terms of service, but we haven't ever changed our terms of service in the middle, you know, middle of crossing the stream.
Yeah.
So, you know, and we worked a long time on that terms of service. As a matter of fact, it delayed launching of websites because we wanted to get it right the first time, you know, and I think.
Yeah, because you don't want to change these things. I mean, unless you absolutely have to, because this is what can happen.
You know, I'm lucky that we've got a lawyer on the team. You know, Barry's like, hold up, this has got to be in there. We can't, you know, you just can't launch without. And most people, they ignore terms of service. They never read them. But if I'm going to a site that I'm going to do business with, Stitcher, if I go over and I look at any place my media is going to be, I read the terms of service from top to bottom, because are they going to own my stuff? Are they going to put advertising in? I'm not going to get compensated. You know, I'm very protective, and most people aren't. They could care less. So.
And probably most people shouldn't really care too much about this stuff either. Yeah. I mean, I think it's businesses that are trying to use a service are probably going to be more concerned about it than an individual would be. But but it's also a reason to flame a company, or to get, you know, the whole, you know, the press will get all, you know, built up around a hoopla around, you know, and this is a really good example, is that I'm sure that the press jumped on it and fanned up the flames, and then all the users actually saw what was going on and had a reaction. So
Rob, you know, I've got a couple more things today, but have you seen anything in the tech space this past week that got your eyebrows raised up a little bit?
No, not too much. I think this one was probably the one that got me most engaged. I think that the other one, and I don't know if we want to go there, is the whole gun control thing. So, you know.
Proud member of the NRA. And I don't necessarily agree with everything they say. And in living in Hawaii, it's they have extreme gun laws here anyway. No, that's probably not a topic we want to go too deep into.
Well, it doesn't have to be about politics, but it, you know, it does come back to some culture, you know, issues. And I think that the NRA definitely raised some things that do have a little bit of connection with tech, and that's around video games, which I thought was, you know, so anyway.
You know, I don't know how we're ever going to be able to control people. You know, we're just not going to be able to. Yeah. People are going to do these just insane things that they do. And it's too bad that, you know, it's a tragedy that happened. But, you know, I was talking to a guy that, not a real close acquaintance, but we were at this Christmas party yesterday, and this topic came up. And of course, everyone was appalled. And he had just purchased, one of these assault weapons. I mean, just within like 2 weeks before this happened. And in Hawaii, you go through a whole process to be able to get access to it and everything else. And it's quite painful. They make it very painful, a long process. And so I said, so, you know, what was it, you know, what was your reaction, or what was the process? You know, how did anything change? He says, the line and the dealer that I went to sold completely out of a specific class of weapon, and the line was like 5 miles long at the police department registering weapons. So, you know, it basically, everyone now scared. And so what are they doing? They're going up and buying everything. Guns, and buying big clips and, you know,
yeah.
And I, you know, I don't even have a handgun in this house. You know, I grew up on a farm country. We hunted animals and, you know, but I never owned an assault rifle, but, it is one of those things that, it's going to be a discussion point in this country for a while, but I don't think that, I don't know, video games. I don't know. And certain people may have a certain preponderance to, you know, but how do you change people? You can't, right?
Paul, you play a lot of those first person shooters. Do you think that there's an impact on younger people?
Nope.
No.
I'm surprised that no one blamed the music of AC/DC on the shooting in Connecticut. You know, I mean, I don't think there's any connection there at all.
Yeah.
You know, and it's pretty politically charged, you know, and it's understandable. You know, it's, you know, I think all of us sick to our stomachs when we heard what happened. And I just can't imagine.
I think we're all trying to find something that we can do to keep these things from happening. And that's what it is at the core. I think that kind of the corollary to this is that because of this whole thing that has spun up, it's actually boosted the sale of guns.
Yeah.
And I'm not exactly sure that guns are at the root of this problem, but I have to admit there's an awful lot of guns in this country.
I
guess that's the bigger topic, right?
Those guns aren't going to go away. Guns. It's
yeah.
The problem with the gun issue and the reason why people who are gun advocates and people who are not are never going to see eye to eye is that I think there's a compromise that can be had that makes sense. But I think people who are gun people don't want to compromise because they see that as a slippery slope where any compromise leads to the next compromise.
And yeah.
I guess I sort of understand that, but I think we've gone off the deep end in the automatic gun direction that it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and I think too is that you know, it's just you got 370 million weapons in America already that are known.
Yeah. Right.
You know, so it's the genie's out of the bottle, and it's not.
I mean, if Red Dawn happens, we're going to be all set.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
Beyond that, it's just unnecessary.
So I just don't know how you put the genie back in the bottle, and people are going to do what they're going to do. It's sick, but it's true. All right, let me moving on to a more frugal content here that's not so serious. Netflix, Facebook sharing bill clears Senate, waiting for the president's signature. So what they've done here is they've made a change to the 1988 Video Privacy Protection Act that basically all they tried to do is make sure that when you rented a porn at a rental place in years past, that they basically it was private that you had done so. So basically now what they've done is they've got the go-ahead to facilitate frictionless sharing of users' viewing history with Facebook or other online services. So basically it looks like they've made a slight modification to the 1988 video privacy. I think movies, whether they're adult or not, that's my business. I'm not necessarily saying that I'm for them sharing. If I'm willing to share that I watched a movie, I'm going to tell people that, right? So
I just looked at Spotify again, which is a music service, but it's the same sort of sharing that can occur. And I hadn't looked at this service in a while. And one of the things I was interested to see was that you can turn on automatic sharing of music to Facebook. And I thought, why would I ever want anyone to know that I just listened to 99 Luft Balloons or some terrible 80s song, you know, because that's embarrassing.
That's right.
And in the same vein, I think that this kind of video sharing thing would be very similar, because every once in a while I'll be home at lunchtime and I'll put Netflix on and there'll be some stinker horror movie or some awful thing. And I, frankly, I'm uncomfortable even knowing myself that I watch it. And it's not, you know, I don't want anyone to know that I watched that. And I think that sometimes that sharing will happen inadvertently, or the way Facebook is designed is that you share things inadvertently. Right. I think it's literally architected that way. I don't, that kind of thing makes me a little nervous. I mean, obviously if you want to share it, that's one thing, but I would be more nervous about the potential for inadvertent sharing.
Yeah. you know, I'll be honest with you. Yeah, I agree. My kids use my Netflix account to watch like all these weird cartoon stuff. Do I want that posted? If you know, why are you?
I can always tell when my daughter Kelly has access Netflix because it's, you know, Cody loves whatever and you know, Teen Nick Jr. or whatever. It's just crazy TV shows.
The biggest mistake I made was my son got the Netflix password and he queued like 5 or 6 videos in a row that were like cartoon stuff. And so I get my, oh, wait, what did we get for Netflix this week? And I'm opening it up. I'm like, why are we watching SpongeBob or whatever we're watching? Mm-hmm. Oh, my video came. I'm just like, there goes my, our movie experience. I just enjoy it. I'm going to bed.
Well, yeah.
And reminds I think me, that, I need to look at that.
The real conflict there is that a lot of these, you know, these media companies or these platforms really have a, you know, a financial interest in us sharing these assets because there may be some sort of revenue share that comes around the actual playback of those things or a transaction or something like that. And I think that that's what we're going to run into is this friction between, you know, these social networks wanting to have us share this stuff, but the real motivation for that, and that gets back to the terms of services somewhat, is that there may be an economic benefit for the company for just doing that, irregardless of whether or not we made that decision or that conscious choice to share this or not. And that's the conflict that we're going to run at is it's basically a business model.
Rob, I guarantee you that they didn't petition senators to put bills through if there wasn't an economic, you know, why would you, if this is not going to add to the bottom line, you know, no one's going to go and, you know, because you almost guaranteed, if you look at the donations that probably Facebook and Netflix made to congressional races, I bet you the same people that they donated to were the ones that introduced these bills and pushed them through.
Yep.
You know, the state of Hawaii right now, we are facing a calamity. We've lost our senior senator. Mm-hmm. He died this past week. They're having interning him in Punchbowl tomorrow. We got 33 senators arriving in Hawaii. And I think part of the reason that they're here is they're looking to see what they can steal because they're going to go back and they're going to, you know, because we're going to, one of their other senators has retired. We have one freshman House of Rep. So we went from being the most seniority in the Congress to having the most. And I knew this was coming. I've talked about this a lot with some of my buddies, and we're going to get 8 alive, and people just have no idea how bad the impact's going to be. So, you know, it's the financial impact to Hawaii will be incredible. And, but so I think maybe these companies better, you know, they've got 2 freshman senators there that are ripe for the picking for companies that are looking to make friends. But boy, oh boy. I don't know how I got
there. So are the vultures circling over the Hawaiian Islands right now? Oh, is absolutely. That what's going on?
Absolutely. I think the shipyard, and I mean, just it's you know, it's.
It sounds horrible there. If I didn't know anything about Hawaii, I would question why you're there.
it's actually a wonderful state to live, and you know, the cost of living is the thing that's the biggest impact. But when I come back to the mainland, it's the same strip mall. It's the same stores. It's the, you know, that's what drives my wife crazy is there's no diversity. And you go, you know, if you travel certain places in the country, there is diversity. But, you know, you go to Japan, which is a country that, you know, obviously is well-established and has been in existence many hundreds of years longer than the United States. Well, let's probably thousands more years than the United States. You go from a village to village and the culture and the things just change from area to area. We don't see that so much in the U.S. The urban development has been almost, you know, it's like rubber stamped. You know, you've been in one McDonald's, you've been in a mall, right? And you don't.
That is American culture, though.
Yeah, that's true.
Unfortunately.
But, you know, it's the diversity of that culture. And I think that's one thing that Hawaii offers is we're not this rubber stamp of everything that is in the what I call the lower 48. It's definitely a different dynamic. We still have the McDonald's and the Burger Kings and the malls and all that stuff, but it's just a different lifestyle for sure. But here nor there. You guys just come find out yourself. Come visit. Get on an airplane.
And when you just might do that, Todd.
When it's cold and wet and you're getting rained on in Seattle, Rob, and when it's snow's blowing and you're shoveling snow, you think Todd is sitting in 85 degree weather in Honolulu drinking Mai Tais. What am I doing here?
Believe me, I've been thinking a lot about that.
That
lately.
Is a nice time to be in the hot tub.
So I do want to show you guys. I got a nice little Christmas present that was delivered. I want to show you guys what I got. You guys drink scotch?
Not too often.
You got me a nice little 12-year Macallan here. So I'm looking forward to opening this up on Christmas Eve. And I'm pretty big fan of Macallan right now. It's my favorite drink, and a listener of the show sent me a bottle, so I'm quite happy about that. So if anyone's watching and wants to send scotch, I wouldn't mind an 18 or a 24-year-old Macallan. That would not at all be denied from delivery. So if you guys done your Christmas shopping, are you ready for Santa Claus? What are you getting yourselves for Christmas this year? Anything special?
I don't know. I think I'm going to get all that figured out this weekend.
You're going to go shopping this weekend. Are you crazy?
Actually, I have to do a little bit this weekend myself, but it's just cleanup work at this point.
My wife was very simple. She, I got it hid down here in a plastic bag. You can see I'm being real careful. When I bought her iPad 3, I bought the white cover for it, and she just ripped me one side down the other. She says, "Why didn't you buy me red?" So I got her a red cover for her iPad. So yeah, I'm a big spender. But anyway, she'll be happy. But
as long as they're happy, that's all you can ask for.
Yeah. So you know, we've been doing the car buying thing too. That was going on last week, wasn't it, Rob? When we were talking about the 24-hour show.
Yeah, I definitely saw that. It was like some Toyota 4Runner or something like that. Is what you were looking for?
It's not in the driveway yet.
Uh huh.
So I did like two deals, got everything ready to be, you know, to go. It is like a fine wine. It takes time. Nothing is going to happen overnight. So I gave her the keys to my CX-9. I said, or the fob. I said, you drive my CX-9 for the next 2 weeks. I'll drive your Costa Canale. You know what a Costa Canale is? A Costa Canale is a car that coasts down one hill and can hardly get up the next. So I'm driving
her. It's Italian.
Yes, I'm driving her Costa Canale and praying that it throws a rod or something like that. Because what I'm going to do is if it breaks down, I'm going to call the tow truck and say, take it to the junkyard and take me to Hertz. And then I'll drive a Hertz rental car in the driveway. And I think that'll help speed the process up a little bit. But you do not. Here, I'm just telling you straight up. You do not want to go car shopping with my wife. You know, it's a whole. Guys are easy. They know what they want. They go in. They negotiate a deal. They buy it.
So weren't you all pissed off because you weren't able to negotiate the price on this thing?
Oh, this goes beyond. Wait till you hear the latest. Well, they negotiated finally a little bit. They come down a whopping $1,300. Okay, that was their discount. So we're looking at an SR5 with a package. And that here's another thing. In Hawaii, you can't buy a 4Runner without a package. They are delivered set. You can't buy just a car without any package. They come with something. It's just the way it is here. And that's a whole nother story. But she's telling me she wants a 4Runner limited. Limited only with no package. You can't get one in Hawaii. But she's, you know, bitching to the car dealer. I want a 4Runner limited. And I'm like, you can't get one, honey. It's just, and she's like, why not? I'm the customer and I agree. She should be able to get what she wants. So I said, okay, let me call Oregon. They have no sales tax. Let me call Oregon and I'll order a car there and we'll have it shipped. It cost me $1,300 to have it shipped. So I call an Oregon dealer. I said, hey, I'm going to be your best customer. I said, I'm ready to buy a car right now. I'm going to do it over the phone. I said, what's the price you can give me for a 4Runner limited? No package. I want it. I'm ready to buy it right now. No messing around. Give me your best price. Came back with an incredible price. I said, fine. I said, put it together. She's like, okay, can I have your name? Put my name, address, 92-329 QL Place, Kapolei, Hawaii. And, oh, we can't sell you a new car. Huh? No, I can't sell you a car over the phone. I'm not allowed to sell you a car in Hawaii from Oregon over the phone. I'm like, can you sell someone from California a car in Oregon? Oh, yeah. Can you sell someone in Washington a car over the phone? Oh, yeah, but I can't in Hawaii. Oh, no, we're restricted. We're not allowed to sell cars that we knowingly are going to Hawaii. I was pissed. Huh. She says, now, if you fly into Seattle, fly into Portland and come buy a car, I can sell you one, but I can't sell you one over the phone. So I can't even buy a freaking car over the phone. They have got a monopoly here that is incredible. But she still wants a 4Runner. Happy wife, happy husband, right?
Well, it's because that there's no sales tax there.
That's okay. Hawaii's got a little form, GT26. Yeah. You pay your 4% on arrival, and you're good. But it's they've got a rule. Honda, a Toyota, does not allow a dealer in a bordering state to sell Hawaii a Toyota. I can order one from Nevada. Nevada guy said, oh, yeah, I'll sell you one. But guess what he's saying? Oh, it's going to be $500 to truck it to Long Beach to put it on the boat. You know, by that time, I might as well just buy it from the dealer here because the delta in price. And remarkably how much those numbers marry up when you figure out shipping and the added sales tax and then the packages they put on their car. They're just, it's evil what they've done. So, so maybe when I go to Vegas, I'll buy a 4Runner and drive it to Long Beach and ship it. So I don't know. We'll see. It's just been nuts. But anyway, she has the paperwork. She wants a car. She can go buy it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. This is not tech. But anyway, guys, thanks for hanging out with me here today. I want to appreciate you showing up and taking time out of your busy holiday schedule. And I had a few people on the stream today. Thanks, guys, for being here. And if you got comments on today's show, geeknews@gmail.com is the place to go and to send your comments and queries. And, you know, so of course we got to make sure we get the plugs in where plugs are due. I want you to make sure that you get over to paulswinsupersite.com. What's going on in the site, Paul?
Well, all kinds of stuff because of all the Microsoft product launches, and my own site actually was relaunched recently. So I've been trying to fix Windows 8 lately. That's been my theme for the week.
So you've been trying to fix? What do you mean by fix? You
know, it's more of a theoretical fix. In other words, my suggestions and then also readers' suggestions about what Microsoft could do to improve Windows 8, you know, over the next year or two as they release various updates and so forth. Because it's a new platform and obviously there are a lot of changes that could be had.
So has your new site design worked out here? Has it been...
Yeah, it's been great. The old site was so terrible. This is just a really nice infrastructure, and it's got a beautiful mobile site and commenting, and you know all the kind of modern stuff you would expect.
Do you find people are clicking into the articles then because you've got them in kind of this abbreviated form on the front page? Does that work? You know, does that seem to be driving your click throughs?
Yeah. No, the readership has been up really dramatically. Actually, it's been great.
Well, that's good. I've always wondered how this type of a format would work, and but definitely check his site out, winsupersite.com. That's the place to go. And Rob, what's anything new for you besides you're still working on your aquatic thing that you're doing out there out back of your house?
Yeah, it's been a little bit. I didn't finish it in time for winter, so it's kind of sitting up there waiting for spring at this point. I didn't actually get it fired up. The aquaponics system, I definitely have all the parts and have everything needed. It's just it's a difficult time of year to fire something like that up. So
do you actually have spring in Seattle? Because I thought it just stayed cold and it turned to summer.
Actually, last summer we had 85 days straight without rain.
Is that pretty amazing? That's some sort of record?
I think it was, yeah.
Because usually it goes like 3 days and it's pissing on you.
This time of the year is like it rains every single day. I mean, it just, and it's socked in cloudy every day.
It's not rain though. Is it more like slush on you or is it really rain?
Well, I guess if you head up into the mountains, it's definitely slushy and snowy. I mean, we've gotten more snow this year than I think we have in the last 10 years or something like that. It's just been, we just got dumped on this year.
Ah, so, yes, I'm so glad I'm here where it's 85.
Yeah.
We've had our fresh.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure Paul's weather's not a whole lot different than ours. I'm sure. Is it really rainy up in your neck of the woods too, Paul?
Yeah. It, usually by now it'd be snowing, but yeah, it's been rainy and freezing. So it hasn't been great.
Well, we had rain showers last week and high trade winds. So I think we were in the high 60s last week. So that was, you know, I guess you can feel bad for us. So
that's very similar. Paul,
I wanted to ask you, what would you say are the top couple things that should be improved on Windows 8?
You know, it's not so much specific issues as it is a bunch of small things. I mm-hmm. think if I were to categorize it, it would just be a maturity issue because all the new stuff in Windows 8 is new. It's a new mobile platform. So there's a lot of little things, you know. Some of the stuff that bugs me is stuff that Microsoft got right already in Windows Phone. And, of course, Windows 8 uses some of the same UI conventions and so forth, but they also went in a completely different direction in some ways. So, you know, it's not like there's some one major feature they could implement that would be fine, but I think in their zeal to push everyone to this touch-centric user interface, they've, you know, they've, I think they've made traditional PC users who today are, by the way, everybody, you know, feel a little ostracized because, you know, they're pushing this next-gen interface of the future, which works great on touch devices and so forth, but that's not what anyone's really using yet. And I just think a little more consideration toward that kind of interchange would have been appreciated. So some of it's around that kind of stuff.
I'm not touching my home computer screen with my finger. It's not happening.
Well, touch is interesting, though, because I always said that, too. But once you have touch, you actually do expect to be able to touch where you can't. And even on a you know, a big desktop computer screen, if you use one of those all-in-one computers that has multi-touch, you find yourself reaching out occasionally to tap the screen. It's very strange.
So do you keep a bottle of Windex and paper towels to clear the smudges?
I don't know. You know, it's like a phone or a tablet. I mean, depending on the angle, you know, you may or may not see it.
I can't do that with a monitor.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that would really help, I think, with the upgrades is that I would love to upgrade my desktop monitor to a touchscreen.
You don't see any of those in the market at all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I went to Best Buy to actually look, and I think they have one touchscreen that you can buy to add on to an existing computer. But it was like $500 for like a 22-inch touchscreen monitor, and that was the only one in the store. So, I mean, until they can really, I think, offer touch screens more as add-ons to computers or second screens, right? I mean, even if I go out and buy like a Surface or something like that and I want to take that and port it over to my large screen on my desk, right? So if I have a dock or something like that, I definitely want like maybe even a 25 to 30-inch monitor that I can just plug into this thing, and it would support touch as well. And it's just little things like that I feel like are kind of missing from the hardware side to actually get this thing moving.
Well, this is always the problem with the new version of Windows. You know, for whatever reason, the devices just aren't there at launch, and they'll filter into the market over the next year. And, you know, this time next year, everything will be fine. But, yeah, it's very classic story, unfortunately.
You know, and finding, and I worked when I was in the Navy before, of course, been retired now 5 years, is that a lot of the screens that we would purchase would be touch screens. And man, incredible pricing on those 5 years ago. I have no idea what they are today. And, you know, they were usually little ones, you know, itty bitty screens. And it would be, you know, a few zeros beyond what you would pay for a normal monitor. So, you know, the technology is there. It's easy. You know, so, you know, companies are making it, just got to put in the overlay. You know, that's all they have to do. But once that's done, it should be a no-brainer for getting bigger screens. It's not like the technology doesn't exist. And actually, it's going to be fantastic because it's going to bring, you know, mass production will bring the price way down. And, cool. All right, guys, need to lock, to close this out. Thanks for being here, guys. And, hey, you guys have a Merry Christmas, okay? And, be safe.
You too.
And Rob, we'll talk whether or not we're going to have another one of these next weekend, because we're going to be getting pretty close to Vegas, and we'll see how the holidays interfere. But everyone, thanks for being here, and we'll see you next time on Saturday Morning Tech.